Okay, well, if you've been sort of processing what we've been doing over the last several weeks, you know that we've come a long way. We started with this basic thesis, and that is that the fallacies in all these books stem from one major central problem. And that is a misunderstanding of the nature and character of God and a misunderstanding of the nature and character of humanity. And so they all share an erroneous view of human nature. And that's a really bad basis on which to argue for a particular worldview or philosophy of life. So starting with Machiavelli and the Prince, and moving on through Hobbes and Hume and Kant and Rousseau and Feuerbach, Julius Wellhausen and Renan, their deconstruction efforts of the Bible, and then on into the writings of Karl Marx and last week Darwin. Is it any wonder that our culture is in the state and condition that it is? I mean, these people have just thoroughly perverted reality and distorted truth. And so we're not even halfway done yet. There's far more damage to be done. But again, I think it explains very well the moral state of our society and culture. You know, among other things, just imagine what it would be like to be a child growing up today in contemporary America. The first generation that's ever grown up in a thoroughly pornified society and culture. Just think of the effects and how children and young teenagers, how exposed they are to pornography and all kinds of degradation that most of us, you know, we encountered it later in life and so on. But it's a very, very serious and tragic situation that we find ourselves in. And a lot of it stems from this idea that there is no transcendent higher purpose and meaning in life. And there's nobody who argues that point any better than Friedrich Nietzsche. So we'll start with him and his book, Beyond Good and Evil. Actually, he wrote several books that I could have included here, but we'll just kind of focus on this particular book just to make it a little more manageable. Now, Nietzsche is what I would call a philosophical anarchist. So think about anarchy. You know, these are just people that want to tear down, okay? They have nothing constructive to offer whatsoever. And Nietzsche is a philosophical and intellectual anarchist. The man is as berserk and as erratic as any thinker in modern history, and yet he's had quite a profound impact on 20th century thought. Now, he is like a lot of these people we've been talking about. He's an atheist, but he's a very militant atheist. And he refers to himself, for instance, in some of his works, alternately as the Antichrist. He actually calls himself the Antichrist. And he also calls himself the crucified one, you know. Now, he typifies, I think, the kind of atheist who, as G.K. Chesterton put it, doesn't so much disbelieve in God as personally dislikes him. Okay, so Chesterton's talking about these people that seem to hate God and hate the idea of God, and maybe they hate God more than they even disbelieve in God. But Nietzsche is oftentimes referred to as the first great apostle of nihilism or nihilism. You know, a worldview that basically is steeped in cynicism, absurdity, and intellectual and moral anarchy. So what is nihilism or nihilism? Well, it's nothingness. There is no purpose, no meaning whatsoever. We're flukes of the universe. And, you know, that pretty much typifies Nietzsche's thinking in most respects, with one exception. The man was quite talented when it came to composing music. His favorite composer was the great German composer Wagner. And in fact, they were friends. And so Nietzsche loved that kind of music. You know, if you think of Wagnerian music, you think of this very martial, militaristic, you know, kind of music that we associate with Prussian militarism and so on. And Nietzsche loved that kind of music. And his greatest dilemma, I guess the only thing that really gave him pause when it came to his militant atheism was, why do we even respond to music like that? What is it about that that touches, well, we would say, touches our soul? I'm sure he didn't believe we actually had a soul, but it certainly affected him emotionally. And he finds great beauty in music. And he couldn't understand why that was the case, because it doesn't make any sense if we live in a godless, purely materialistic universe. It's just sound is all it is. And why would we say that some sound is, quote, beautiful? I mean, there's no basis for saying that if everything is purely naturalistic and materialistic. So anyway, I just say that to say that Nietzsche actually claimed that he was not a nihilist, a nihilist, but in fact, in most every respect, he clearly was. Now, also, the man's a relativist, a moral relativist, and an epistemological relativist. In other words, a relativist would be someone who believes that there is no transcendent absolute truth about anything. Everything is a matter of opinion. And in fact, that's essentially what Nietzsche claimed. Everything is purely subjective, and there is no truth. And he wrote, for instance, there are no facts, only interpretations. There are no facts, only interpretations. And he called truth nothing but a, quote, mobile army of metaphors. Now, he was very dogmatic about that. So we could say that according to Nietzsche, the truth is that there is no truth. And he was very absolute about those sorts of things. Now, he's influenced by certainly thinkers that came before him, everybody from Machiavelli to Charles Darwin. And Nietzsche concludes that human beings are merely highly evolved animals. Life has absolutely no meaning and no purpose whatsoever. All that matters, according to Nietzsche, is that we survive. And how do we survive in this cruel, cold, cruel world? Well, we have to do it by dominating and subjugating all of our competition, which most, not only the animal kingdom, but, you know, our fellow human beings as well. And if need be, exterminate our competition. And now, in order to do that, we cannot be bound by any kind of moral restrictions because, again, there is no such thing as morality. So, as Nietzsche would put it, we have to go beyond good and evil. You know, good and evil, in his mind, is low-level, simplistic thinking. And he's achieved a level of understanding far and above that sort of pedestrian idea of right and wrong, good and evil, okay? So you understand, of course, that there's an intrinsic contradiction here. As we've said before, all false belief systems have inherent contradictions because they're not true. And so as far as Nietzsche is concerned, he's going to be arguing that life has no purpose and meaning and that we're just highly evolved animals, and yet he seems to live and to write as if his life had meaning and purpose. He's certainly pouring an awful lot of energy into his books and philosophical treatises, and that would imply that he must have found some value in them. But, of course, he'll claim that there is no value in life. Okay, so, again, total contradiction. Any comments before we move on? Now, you might find it interesting that Nietzsche actually started out in life studying for the ministry. And His father was a Lutheran pastor. His father died when young Friedrich was just 5 years old. But his mother wanted him to go to the university and study theology. So he went to the University of Bonn, one of the most prestigious schools in Germany at the time. But he dropped out after one semester and freely admitted that he was an atheist. He didn't believe any of this stuff. And the University of Bonn, like most of these prestigious German universities at this time, had become very liberal, very theologically liberal. But in Nietzsche's mind, say, theological liberalism is just a compromise. In fact, there is no truth and there is no God. And so theological liberals are just a bunch of hypocrites. They claim to be Christians, but in fact they don't believe much of anything associated with the historic Christian faith. So the truly honest person, the courageous person, would want nothing to do with theological liberalism, just as they'd want nothing to do with, you know, traditional Orthodox Christianity either. Now, how does he become such a skeptic, such a cynic, so early in life? Well, he had some good influences. One was a book that we've talked about before, David Strauss's book called The Life of Jesus, Critically Examined. And you might remember this several weeks ago. It was one of those books that critiqued the idea of the historical Jesus and argued that, in fact, nothing that we read in the New Testament, in the Gospels and the rest of the New Testament, has anything remotely to do with the real, actual historical Jesus. It's all just mythology and legend. So David Strauss, he's a great influence on Nietzsche. And then there's others, of course, like Darwin, and especially Darwin's idea that all of life is a struggle for existence. And this resonated very well with Nietzsche. The man apparently has no social skills. He has very few friends in life. For him, everything is a matter of competition. And so this Darwinian idea of survival of the fittest seems to suit him and his prejudices and his personality quite well. Another influence is, as I said, the German composer Richard Wagner. Now, Nietzsche tries to get a position teaching in a prestigious German university, and he's rejected. And in fact, this seemed to have created a tremendous amount of bitterness in his life, resentment and bitterness. But because of his outspoken atheism, remember now, again, see, it would be fine if he were a liberal Christian, but he's way beyond that. He's anti-God. And at this point, even German universities, that was beyond their range of tolerance. Okay, so like Karl Marx, who we talked about a couple of weeks ago, he wants to be a prestigious university professor, but he fails in doing so, and it very much embitters him. He becomes addicted to opium and lives a life of lonely isolation for most of his life. He has very, very few friends. And about 10 years before he dies, and you see there the dates of his life, and he dies in the year 1900, early in 1900. But about 10 years prior to that, he suffers a mental breakdown, and he's confined to a psychiatric institute for a year. And then for the rest of his life, his mother and then his sister take care of him as his health is declining. And finally, in 1900, he contracts a pneumonia and dies of a stroke. So a little bit about the life of Friedrich Nietzsche. So according to all his biographers, I mean, this is not somebody that you would want to cultivate a close friendship with. He's bitter, he's reclusive, cynical, and his writings certainly reflect, you know, his rather unique personality. Again, any comments, questions before we move on? Yes, Wayne?
He has perhaps the most impressive mustache I've ever seen.
He did grow a very impressive mustache. And in fact, that was one, probably his main accomplishment in life. And you're right, it was very, very, very outstanding. Okay. All right. Now, one of his most famous works was a book called The Antichrist. And as the title might suggest, it was nothing but an anti-Christian diatribe. And it's in that book that Nietzsche helps perpetuate what we call the conflict theory myth. This idea that science and the Christian faith have been locked in a life and death struggle since the beginning, that Christianity has been the greatest impediment to the growth and expansion of science in Western history. Now, this is an absurd myth. If you look at the history of the interaction, the real history of the interaction between Christian faith and science, you find a very strong correlation. But beginning in the late 1800s, and actually it started with Thomas Huxley, who was, remember, self-described as Darwin's bulldog, Darwin's most vociferous proponent, this conflict theory emerged, and that is that Christianity has been an enemy of the growth of science. And then it was perpetuated, that theory was perpetuated by a couple of very prestigious American university professors, Draper and White. And Nietzsche also picks up on that theme, and he promotes it in this book, The Antichrist. And for instance, in The Antichrist, Nietzsche will write, quote, "A religion like Christianity, which does not have contact with reality in any way, must naturally be morally hostile against," quote, "the wisdom of this world," which means science. So he's taken that verse out of context, you know, where, is it John who's saying that friendship with this world is hostility toward God? Isn't it in John's epistles? And he's taken that out of context, and basically he's saying that Christianity is totally out of touch with reality, and that it's naturally opposed to true wisdom and knowledge, which is what we gain through science. He goes on to say faith as an imperative is the veto against science. So he despises Christianity. He's bought into this conflict theory idea. But he also hates Christianity and despises Christianity because Christianity, as he calls it, is based on the morality of pity, or in other words, the morality of compassion toward those whom Jesus called the least of these, the poor, the weak, the vulnerable, and so on. And Nietzsche thought this was the most ridiculous thing imaginable because, so he's bought into this Darwinian scheme of things, survival of the fittest. And he sees Christianity as one of the greatest impediments to human evolution because Christians actually go out of their way to try and help the least of these. So they're impeding, you know, the whole evolutionary process. So he thought that there was absolutely no place in the real world for pity and compassion and so on. Now, he also puts forth, what might rightly be described as a gospel of nihilism. He celebrates nihilistic values because Nietzsche sees nihilism as reality. In other words, he sees nihilism or meaninglessness as the way things actually are. See, and he would say that those who are not nihilists, like Christians and many other people, are just out of touch with reality, or they're denying the realities of life. And this is how he puts it. A nihilist, he says, is a man who judges that the real world, the world that we experience in this life, that the real world ought not to be, and that the world as it is let me repeat that. A nihilist is a man who judges that the real world ought not to be, and that the world as it ought to be does not exist. And he goes on to say, "I praise, I do not reproach, nihilism's arrival. I believe it is the one, one of the greatest crises, a moment of the deepest self-reflection of humanity. Whether man recovers from it, whether he becomes master of this crisis, is a question of his own strength. So Nietzsche's saying, you know, we're privileged today, his day, to be living in an age where Western civilization in general is moving away from God, because all that is just silly superstition in the first place. And once you move away from God, see, he's insightful enough to realize that all standards and all beliefs will collapse. And he says, but that's good, because belief in God is not realistic. That's not reality. So it's good that we're entering into a period of nihilism where people don't believe anymore. And because that's going to set us up for a better world to come. But that better world to come, as he sees it, is a world of just intense struggle and competition between individuals and between nations and so on. So you say, wow, that's just bleak, you know? I mean, but he'd say that's reality, that's the truth. Although, again, he doesn't claim that there is any objective truth, but he'd make that claim. So people that believe in something, who believe in morality, who believe in the Christian faith and so on, these people are just cowards. They're intellectual cowards. They won't admit that this life, this purely materialistic, naturalistic life that we live, has absolutely no purpose whatsoever. So according to Nietzsche, it's only when nihilism destroys all confidence in past beliefs, it's only then that a culture can have a true foundation on which to exist. So hopefully you're thinking, this guy's nuts. And he is, but he also, as we'll talk about in just a moment, has some rather keen insights into what this coming world is going to be, this post-Christian world. Say. So Christianity is foolishness, it's a myth, it's a legend, we ought to discard it as every other religion too, and we ought to deal with reality, but the coming reality is going to be a really scary world in which to live. But courageous people face up to it. And through willpower, they will triumph in the coming society that will come after Christianity. So again, any comments, questions before we get even more depressed here? Yes.
That view that between world, because the world accepts nihilism, it will be there'll be a big, much bigger struggle. Life is much more difficult. That implies the life before nihilism is not so competitive, not such a big struggle. So life was better before. Well, I'm not sure what. I mean, this is just this desperation he gets into.
Yeah. He would say
true, even though, you know.
Yeah, he would say that life is going to get increasingly violent and contentious. But that's good, because that's reality.
Say. That's a Darwinian reality.
Yeah, and the strongest human beings, the most courageous human beings, will flourish, you know, in this coming post-Christian world. But Christianity has worked against the laws of nature in his mind, because Christianity is all about love and compassion and service and so on, and taking care of the least of these. And so Christians are actually impeding the evolutionary process, including social evolution, not just biological, but social evolution. Okay. All right. So let's go on here to the death of God. Okay. Now, Nietzsche is most remembered for his statement, God is dead, in a book he wrote called The Gay Science. I have no idea where that title came from. But anyway, this death of God concept is oftentimes misunderstood, but this is essentially what Nietzsche is arguing. He's saying there never actually has been a God, in the biblical sense, okay? But now, with the advance of science, even the very concept of a God has become outdated and passé, because we're learning more all the time how the natural world actually works. It works according to natural laws. Well, actually, he didn't even believe in natural laws that govern the universe. He actually thought that even in nature, including impersonal nature and planets and stars and so on, that all works on the basis of power relationships too. The more powerful planets and stars and whatever dominate their neighbors and rivals. And again, this is just, pretty absurd. But if he actually believed in natural physical laws, then where did those things come from anyway? And he certainly doesn't want to go there. Okay. So anyway, there never actually had been an actual literal God such as the God of the Bible. Now, with the advance of science, the very idea of God has become passé. In other words, God is no longer a necessary concept in order to explain reality. Science has outrun belief in God. Okay. Furthermore, he says, belief in God no longer stirs the human imagination or governs how people live their lives. Now again, see, he's living in the late 19th century in Germany, which is becoming increasingly secularistic, and so he's kind of myopic, his understanding of Western civilization is mostly what's going on in Germany in his day and time, and Germany's in the forefront of all of this nihilism and all of this anti-God, worldview and so on. The rest of Western civilizations maybe a few years behind, and certainly America would be decades behind what's going on in Germany. Now, having said that, Nietzsche understands what the moral and the social and the political ramifications would be when it comes to, quote, the death of God. In other words, he describes himself as an immoralist. He doesn't believe in morality. He's an immoralist. And he understands the moral and the social ramifications of what will happen once a critical mass of people no longer believe in God, no longer believe in the Christian faith. And he says, it's going to take time for the word to filter down to the great unwashed masses, but eventually the news of the death of God is going to change everything. In fact, he considers this news to be the good news. This is the gospel. This is the good news. And he says, if God is dead, then there are no external or absolute standards by which we can measure what is true and what is good and what is beautiful. And he finds this very, very liberating, because now everything is just, again, going to operate on a naturalistic, materialistic plane. The Christian author James Sire puts it this way. He says, Nietzsche saw humanity floating in an infinite sea with no fixed star by which to navigate, no port to call its home, no purpose to the journey. So it's like, being out on the Pacific Ocean in a raft or something like that, and not being able to even use the stars to navigate. You're just floating aimlessly in this enormous sea, and you're not going anywhere. You have no idea where you are in the world or, what the purpose of it all is. And again, this is similar to what, for instance, the Russian novelist Dostoevsky would observe when he wrote that if there is no God, then everything is possible. In other words, if there is no God, then all human behavior is possible. If there is no God, there's no standard to measure anything, whether it's good or true or beautiful. And so, again, see, Nietzsche finds this liberating because it's reality as far as he understands reality. Now, having said all this, Nietzsche is actually a bit of a social prophet. He looks down the corridor of time and he sees the implications of the erosion of belief in a fully theistic concept of God, a fully biblical understanding of God. He sees what's coming as a result. And with the death of God comes certain inevitable consequences. And furthermore, he'll argue, a culture cannot lose its philosophical and its theological and its moral center and long survive. Inevitably, he says, there's going to come a total breakdown of human society on every level, individually, on the family level, community level, the social level, and eventually it's going to affect the entire culture. So again, let me just pause at that point and say, you know, in this respect, is that not what we're seeing in our own generation here? Now, not quite as extreme as what Nietzsche posits here, but with fewer and fewer people in our society, in America, fewer and fewer people feeling that they have to live in accord with the standards and the truth of Scripture, what we find is an unbelievable social breakdown. And, you know, for many of us, it's just absolutely alarming what's going on in our society and our culture. I mean, gosh, you go back 20, even 20 years ago, or 40 or 50 years ago, and in, a lot of what's going on today would have been absolutely unimaginable. Again, just one example, we're living, for the first time in American civilization, we're living in a society that's just absolutely inundated with pornography. And that's unprecedented, isn't it? And imagine the consequences of that for children and teenagers and young adults who are growing up today. But Nietzsche sees that, and he sees that there's going to be, with the loss of belief in God, there's going to come a total breakdown individually, in terms of families, you know, all of our social institutions, and our entire culture. So, with the collapse of all these moral boundaries, humanity is going to be free to pursue, in his words, the deification of passions. And, as he puts it, splendid animality. In other words, no longer will there be any moral restraints, and our passions will become our God. You know, the pursuit of pleasure is going to become our God, and we can live like highly evolved animals. Okay, and this is the good news, as far as he's concerned. Okay, now, he's particularly contemptuous of humanists of his day who are optimistic about the future of Western civilization. And some of these secular humanists, for instance, who are predicting a better and a brighter future for humanity once we did away with Christianity. And he sees these people for what they are. They're fools, say. And Os Guinness, actually commenting on this, puts it this way. The secular humanists claimed that they could retain Christian values, like, for instance, the inherent dignity of mankind, or some objective basis for justice, for instance. So the secular humanists claimed that they could retain Christian values and give them a validity independent from God. But Nietzsche understood what was going on, and he dismissed this as impossible, since the Christian faith was the entire undergirding of all Western civilization. See, unlike the secularists, the humanists, Nietzsche understood our entire civilization was built, in part at least, on a Christian understanding of reality. not only the religious beliefs of Christianity, but also its social values and its fundamental view of human nature. Again, we come back to that seminal idea of human nature. If we get that wrong, if we get the nature and character of God wrong, then truly we're adrift. Okay, and Nietzsche understands that. Now, Nietzsche's diagnosis was not progress, but a time of decadence, whose logic is nihilism. There remains only the void. You know, once everything has been torn down, there remains just temporary chaos, anarchy, or the void. Human beings, then, are falling. Their dignity is now gone. Their values are lost. For those who would not face the desperate extremity of the truth that's been imposed on them, Nietzsche had nothing but scorn. See, these are cowards. These are people that refuse to live courageously in a godless world. Nietzsche agreed with Jacob Burckhardt, a famous German historian, in hating, quote, the odious windbags of progressive optimism, talking again about these Enlightenment products of the Enlightenment, these people that saw a better future for Western civilization now that it was entering into a post-Christian phase. So hating the odious windbags of progressive optimism and saw only the horror of the abyss. Now, once the masses realize the implication that there's no God, they'll be driven into despair, or what Nietzsche called the great seasickness, and that is a world without God and a world with no real hope. So, writing in the year 1880, Nietzsche warns that a new age of barbarism is going to descend on Europe, on Western civilization. And this is how he puts it. Our whole European culture is moving, and it has been for some time now, with a tortured tension that's growing from decade to decade as toward a catastrophe. He goes on to say, there will be wars such as have never happened before on Earth. So here he is in 1880, say, now this is going to be 34 years before the outbreak of World War I, you know, which, remember, they before World War II, they called it the Great War because it was the greatest war in all of human history, and nobody could ever imagine that there would be an even greater war than World War I. And Nietzsche basically predicts this. See, we're entering into an age of barbarism now that we've killed God and rejected, you know, Christianity. Now, he also sees the rise of totalitarianism. The death of God leaves human beings too weak to live without rules, and inevitably, who's going to fill the gap? Well, the state. And he says the state will become the new idol, and it'll be established as a substitute for the absolute. In other words, it'll become a substitute for God, forcing people to serve itself rather than God. So here he's writing again a few decades before the advent of Bolshevism, communism, Nazism, fascism, and all these other totalitarian systems. And he's saying, yeah, that's precisely what's going to happen, see, because with the death of God comes the collapse of all sense of morality, right and wrong, and all restrictions on the worst impulses of humanity. So basically, with Nietzsche, all this man is doing, see, he's just simply taking the implications and the consequences of atheism to their logical conclusions. And most atheists don't have the courage to follow their belief system to its logical conclusion, see. But he does. And in that sense, as Oz Guinness puts it, Nietzsche, at least, was courageous enough in facing nihilism squarely. In other words, he actually faced up to the consequences of his nihilistic philosophy, something that most people refuse to do. Okay. So we have, and it's of course, an increasing situation in our increasingly secularistic culture, more and more people who claim to be agnostics and, you know, atheists or whatever, anything other than Christians. And, you know, most of these people, of course, most people don't think philosophically in the first place, but most of these people don't realize just exactly what the final implication of their skepticism is. But Nietzsche sees it for what it is. It's a world in which it'll descend into chaos and barbarism. But chaos and barbarism, well, that's only a temporary condition. It's a void. And that void's going to be filled, and it's going to be filled by, in his mind, totalitarianism. Okay, so in that sense, the man is a bit of a secular prophet. Okay. Comments or questions there? Unless you're just so depressed, you can't. There's no such thing as good. It just is. It's just reality. But you know, like you know, Bob, for somebody to claim there is no truth is tantamount to claiming there's no reality, which makes no sense. I mean, you know, ask people today, do you believe in truth, absolute truth? And many people will equivocate, or some might even say, well, no, I don't believe there is such truth, such a thing as truth. Well, ask them if they believe in reality. Is there such a thing as reality? And unless they're just playing silly intellectual games with you, everybody's going to have to concede, well, yeah, I mean, yeah, I believe in reality. Well, you know, that's tantamount to believing in truth. Yes, Bob?
I really don't see a connection or why barbarism would lead to totalitarianism, why that's the end. Why does it stop with totalitarianism? Barbarism. I mean, logic flows to nihilism, flows to barbarism, which is anarchy. That should be the end.
Well, but he knows human nature well enough to realize that that's a temporary void, and somebody's going to fill the void. I mean, it works that way in the animal kingdom. I mean, the strongest prevail, and they dominate everything else. So we're just animals. We're just highly evolved animals. So we've been acting as if we're special, that we were created by a personal God and so on. But with the death of that, we descend into a splendid animality. In other words,
totalitarianism for him is not a utopia.
No. And basically, he doesn't take it beyond that. So, yeah. So he doesn't take it beyond that. So he can't see beyond totalitarianism. But yeah, it seems like he would definitely recoil, because he is such an arrogant, independent thinker. He thinks he's above common humanity. So people like that usually are not tolerated too well in a totalitarian system, you know. But again, keep in mind, the man's half nuts. So to bring us back to reality, by the way. So, yeah, Bob.
Speak a little more about how did he ever become so famous? I mean, each of us walked in this room probably not knowing a lot about what he taught, but we knew the name, we knew he was a bad guy. So he was famous, but he had such a depressing outlook. But could you speak a little more about how?
Well, his books didn't sell that well during his lifetime. But after he died, he became more and more of a celebrity in some circles. For instance, anarchists, and Europe was full of anarchists, they loved him. You know, they thought he was a great prophet. Strangely, totalitarians also loved him selectively, because they saw the implications of his whole worldview leading to a totalitarian state. Now, how he becomes relatively popular in Western civilization, he taps in, I think, to the very basest, worst impulses in our civilization. So there's always going to be an audience for this kind of cynicism and nihilism, because there's a lot of people who prefer to live on this level. But again, they're just living a lie. You know, nobody can live according to these principles. Ask the most cynical nihilistic person you know, and they may deny that their life has any meaning, but they all live and act as if their life had meaning, you know. Otherwise, they'd either, you know, they'd all commit suicide, because after all, what does it matter? Or they wouldn't commit suicide, because after all, what does it matter? But why would they even get up, get out of bed in the morning, you know, if they actually believed this nonsense? So I think it resonates with our very worst impulses and resonates so deeply within our sin nature.
So at what point in this evolution of his mind did he go on drugs?
Pretty early on, yeah.
I could see him taking himself to drugs.
Mm-hmm.
After concluding this.
Mm-hmm. In fact, let's see, if we look at all of his most famous works, he was addicted to drugs before he wrote any of those. So
it only got better with drugs?
Yeah, I guess. I don't know.
What I want to understand is why, when you look how negative and sad and divisive it is, why would that not turn people to want to have God's at least as standards? To give at least some purpose and joy.
Okay. Well, see, what this whole mindset leads to is, again, nihilism in its fullest expressions. Now, since very few human beings can live in a state of nihilistic despair, the 20th century philosophy is mostly all about trying to manufacture meaning and purpose in a godless world. So what is the popular philosophy of the 20th century that tries to take everything we've talked about here and yet pretend that you can still live a meaningful, purposeful life? What do we call that particular philosophy? Yes, that's existentialism. Not to be confused with Christian existentialism, which is very different. But that's existentialism. See, because people can't live in this state of mind. But Nietzsche would say that the existentialist is just in denial. He's a coward, and he's living in denial.
But courage, too, though. I mean, it takes courage to believe nihilism.
Foolish arrogance, which he would call courage.
But in his statement, the death of all external and absolute standards of truth, goodness, and beauty, he found that liberating.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think people that are trying to get away from God, intellectuals are trying to run from God, find this liberating. It's an intellectual justification.
Right.
Yeah, there really is no truth. There is no goodness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's like Dora, it's a place to stand. It gives them justification for what they want to
do. You can be the captain of your own soul. You can be your own God. And many people find that very liberating. You can act any way you want to. Believe anything you want to, treat people any way you please. It doesn't matter if there is no moral standard. So, again, is this not a wonderful example of the depths of human depravity, total depravity, as Calvin, you know, would have put it? How low can a human being sink? Well, I think we've reached the bottom here, because as I said, most 20th century philosophy is an attempt to manufacture meaning, you know, despite all that's come before it. Say. Yes, Doug?
Two things. He has no credentials.
No credentials? I don't know if he had a PhD or what, but he wasn't.
You said he didn't finish. I guess maybe that's the.
You know, he actually did teach in a university for a few years, but he was a philologist. He wasn't a philosopher, and I don't know if he had a doctorate degree or what, but, you know, anyway, for what that's worth.
Didn't, I know he got hit right next, but didn't he have people read one of Nietzsche's books or something?
Hitler?
Yeah.
The Nazis kind of borrowed from Nietzsche selectively, very selectively, the parts that served their purposes. Mm-hmm. This idea that all of life is a titanic struggle, you know, for dominance. Well, yeah, that fits well with Nazi propaganda, Nazi ideology. But no, they certainly would not have been in accord with his ideas that were descending into anarchy or anything like that. Yeah.
So
I just heard that maybe he was giving out his books or something, or his book.
No, Hitler used to. There was a Nietzsche museum. Let's see, in Weimar, Germany, and Hitler used to like to go there to the Nietzsche museum. And I nobody really knows if Hitler read many of his books or not, but he certainly was familiar with Nietzsche and admired him selectively, at least. Okay, well, there's still a couple of points. We haven't totally exhausted the wisdom of this man. So Nietzsche understands, see, that because he has the courage to celebrate a post-Christian civilization, he understands he's well out in front of the curve. Okay, most people are not even remotely at the same point of evolutionary development that he is. And so he says, you know, most intellectuals in Europe, well, they're still products of the Enlightenment. They still are clinging to old-fashioned Enlightenment optimism and rationalism and optimistic humanism, where they think that we can do away with God and we can still build a very good and just, you know, society. And likewise, he says, the masses of humanity are still living in the past, under the illusion that there's a benevolent personal God who's in charge of everything that's going on. And so he puts forth this famous parable, the parable of the madman, to sort of exemplify in his mind where we are as a civilization. And in his parable of the madman, a man enters into a marketplace with a lantern, and he travels throughout the marketplace crying out, "I seek God. I seek God." Kind of reminds you of Diogenes the Cynic, if you remember, you know, in ancient Greek philosophy, you know, the man with the lantern who was looking for one honest man in all of Greece or something like that. Diogenes the Cynic was about as loony as Nietzsche. So anyway, this man enters the marketplace with a lantern crying out, "I seek God, I seek God." And the crowd is very busy buying and selling, and they just laugh at him, and they dismiss him as some kind of a crazed lunatic. And then he finally loses his patience with them, and he turns on the crowd, and he declares, quote, "Whither is God? I shall tell you." In other words, where is God? Whither is God? "I shall tell you. We have killed him, you and I. All of us are his murderers." And then he goes on to say, "Do we not smell anything yet of God's decomposition? Gods too decompose. God is dead, and we've killed him. How shall we, the murderers of all murderers, comfort ourselves?" And yet the crowd is totally unimpressed and unconcerned, because after all, they're just a bunch of materialists. All they care about is pleasure and shopping and buying and, you know, that kind of stuff. And so they ignore the madman's harangue. So he finally smashes his lantern to the ground and proclaims, quote, "I've come too early. My time has not yet come. The tremendous event is still on its way, still wandering, but it has not yet reached the ears of man." In other words, he's telling them, you all are so caught up in your little lives and your materialistic pleasure pursuits, you don't understand what is happening in our society, in our culture. And so my message you don't even understand, you know. And my time has not yet come, but it is going to come. So the parable of the madman. So what's the solution to all this decadence, all this violence, impending violence, and so on? Well, the only solution to living in a godless world, according to Nietzsche, is for human beings to become their own god. So in this sense, there's kind of this odd teleological component to Nietzsche's philosophy. In other words, he actually seems to believe that there is a goal. We call that in philosophy teleology, you know. And he believes that there's a purpose or a goal. And that purpose in life is to overcome nature. And we can only do this to the extent that we live courageously. And he calls a person who accepts the challenges of his day what we would call a superman or a superhuman. The German word is the Übermensch. And this is where he'll argue that everything in life, see, is a power struggle. Now, those of you who are familiar with philosophical concepts know that that sounds very much like modern postmodernism. Okay, everything is a power struggle. Postmodernism is what we oftentimes describe as an anti-philosophy, but it's sort of the prevailing mentality in academia today and probably throughout American society as well. And so according to Nietzsche, the superhuman, see, asserts his own individuality and creates his own reality by rising above the beliefs and the values of the common people, and he rejects the superstitions and the moral principles of the masses. In other words, the superhuman accelerates his own personal evolution through the force and the exercise of his own personal willpower. And so that's the goal in life, apparently. But see, to speak of life having a goal, again, that's nonsense given his naturalistic, materialistic worldview. So, but again, we shouldn't try to hold him to consistency. Because he's largely a liar, you know, he's a liar, and what he's spreading is untruth. But it's an untruth that, again, I think, as I said, has particular appeal to maybe the most base sinful elements of human nature. Any comments, questions? Yes, Bob.
An ideal of the world as it ought to be.
Yes. Yeah.
I believe that it was not going to be, or that it was not anywhere. And yet the world it was or should not be. So I can see the contradiction and those tensions.
Yeah, I think you're right there. The reason the world is dysfunctional today, he would say, is because people are living inauthentically. They believe life has meaning and purpose because there's a God. But now we're transitioning to a post-Christian culture, Germany, eventually Europe, and it's coming here, of course. And so, you know, once that happens, we have to face up with the reality of the situation and live authentically, which means that we live according to the principles of the animal kingdom. And it's all about power and domination. And that's the gospel of Nietzsche.
Do you actually believe that would be better?
Probably would not even want to use a word like better, because better implies that there's a standard for best, you know. So he would just say it is. So if you don't believe in God, all you can say about what exists is that it is. But you can't say whether it ought to be this way or whether it's good or beautiful or true. It just is. So again, this is the depths to which people will sink to avoid individual accountability before God. This is how absurd people can be in order to evade the moral law of God. It's sick and perverted, isn't it? All right. Well, oh dear. We're going to have to play fast and loose here with Adolf Hitler. Well, compared to Nietzsche, who, in some respects, is a kind of an interesting creature, again, with his understanding of the consequences of a civilization that's post-Christian. With Hitler, well, there's not a whole lot here that's all that interesting. And then certainly there's nothing about Hitler that is discreet or anything like that. Now, his great work, of course, was Mein Kampf. He writes it in 1925. This is before, of course, this is 8 years before the Nazis actually were invited into the government and then eventually took over the German government. So the Nazi movement is still in the process of developing during these years. Hitler actually writes it when he's in prison. And the Nazis had tried to promote a revolution, and they didn't have sufficient strength among the local populace in Munich, so a bunch of them got killed and others got thrown in the prison. So anyway, it's during that period that Hitler will write Mein Kampf. It's similar in some respects to Machiavelli's book, The Prince. It's a truly evil book. It's utterly amoral. It's totally pragmatic. And it basically offers an agenda for rulers whose goal it is to conquer and subjugate their enemies and do it by any means necessary, regardless of how unscrupulous or how brutal you have to be. Now, his whole philosophy and vision was essentially what I would call a witch's brew, and he borrows from several sources. For instance, German nationalism, including this strong tradition of Prussian militarism in German history. Machiavellian power politics, which again, see, is totally amoral, totally ruthless in its approach to governing, totally based on lies and deception and whatever. It's all about power. He learns from Hobbes the principles of authoritarianism, that the only good state, the only state that will survive is one that's totalitarian, authoritarian, that controls people's lives in every way. Also, Nietzschean pragmatism. Many of the top Nazis were disciples of Nietzsche, at least to some extent. Now, one good example of a Nazi who was apparently very devoted to Nietzsche was Heinrich Himmler of the SS. And early on, Himmler told his SS officials, this came as the German army invaded Poland at the beginning of World War II, and immediately, as you know, horrible atrocities took place in Poland against Jews and against Poles who were opposed to the Nazis. And Himmler tells his SS officials, who are charged with deporting Jews and other criminals in their mind to concentration camps, Himmler says, quote, "I expect you to do superhuman acts of inhumanity." And again, Himmler was one of these that was very familiar with Nietzsche. And again, that sentence alone sort of, you know, conjures up Nietzschean ideas. "I expect you to do superhuman acts," you know, the superman, "superhuman acts of inhumanity." And of course, in the Nazi mind, it was all justified because they were exterminating inferior races and promoting evolution, human evolution in the process, which leads us to point number five. Hitler's also inspired and motivated by the Darwinian survival of the fittest theory, or as, again, another top Nazi official, Rudolf Hess, put it, "National Socialism is nothing but applied biology." Okay. National Socialism, Nazism, is only applied biology. So, you know, again, we're actually promoting the advancement of humanity, the evolution of humanity. And then, of course, there's an element of race-based eugenics and Aryan supremacy in all of this. Hitler's very unequivocal about his commitment to racial supremacy. He writes that the highest aim of human existence is not the maintenance of the state or the government, but rather the conservation of the race. So Hitler, even though he's a very ardent German nationalist, he says, you know, there's actually something even higher and nobler and grander than the state, and that is to purify the race and to perpetuate a pure race. And so that requires that eugenics be carried out. In other words, purifying the human race by eliminating those that are supposedly inferior. And rather than doing something wrong, the Nazis actually believe they're serving the greater good of humanity. They're purifying the human gene pool, and they're eliminating these inferior peoples. Or as one very notable Nazi physician, Gerhard Wagner, put it, "It was the mission of every German physician to attend to the promotion and the perfection of the health of the German people, to ensure that the people realize the full potential of their racial and genetic endowment." And he goes on to say that part of this mandate was to assure that unworthy and racially alien people are prevented from procreating in order to keep our blood pure and increase those of sound heredity. Okay. So again, this whole sickening mindset of racial purity and eugenics and so on, very integral, as you know, to the whole Nazi mentality, the whole Nazi ideology. And very few people read Mein Kampf anymore. In fact, the book has been banned in Germany for many decades. I don't know if it's been banned all the way back to World War II or not, but it's virtually impossible to get a German translation of Mein Kampf, but of course it's readily available in English and certainly on the internet. But anyway, this is what Hitler says about eugenics and racial purity in one of the more famous passages in Mein Kampf. He writes, quote, the Völkisch concept of the world recognizes that the primordial racial elements are of the greatest significance for mankind. In principle, the state is looked upon only as a means to an end, and this end is the conservation of the racial characteristics of mankind. So, you know, we need a totalitarian state because it will enforce racial purification. Therefore, on the Völkisch principle that we cannot admit that one race is, therefore, on the Völkisch principle, we cannot admit that one race is equal to another. Saying, no, there is no equality between the races. By recognizing that they are different, the Völkisch concept separates mankind into races of superior and inferior quality. On the basis of this recognition, it feels bound in conformity with the eternal will that dominates the universe, an eternal will that dominates the universe, whatever he meant by that, to postulate the victory of the better and the stronger and the subordination of the inferior and the weaker. The Völkisch belief denies that an ethical ideal has the right to prevail if it endangers the existence of a race that is the standard bearer of a higher ethical principle. For in a world which would be composed of mongrels and negroids, all ideals of human beauty and nobility and all hopes of an idealized future for our humanity would be lost forever. Goes on to say, on this planet of ours, human culture and civilization are indissolubly bound up with the presence of the Aryan. It should be, if he should be exterminated or subjugated, then the dark shroud of a new barbarian era would enfold the earth. Hence, the folk concept of the world is in profound accord with nature's will. Now, again, was Hitler an atheist? Well, nobody quite seems to know. I mean, he certainly operates out of an atheistic worldview, to say the least, but he never actually declared himself an atheist. But I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, at least confidentially, he was an agnostic. But
he taught that faith was actually useful.
Yes.
For moral values in society.
That's right.
They could use it.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
So he'll use the church and use it very very cynically and very effectively there in Germany, both the Catholic Church and the Protestant churches, the primarily Lutheran but also the Reformed churches, and he'll exploit them very effectively to enforce, you know, the Nazi system. And he understands that religion can be a useful tool in the hands of a dictator to keep people in line. Okay. But of course, ultimately, they're going to have to swear allegiance to him. And overwhelmingly, the, quote, Christians of Germany will do just that. They'll swear allegiance to Hitler. I'm sure out of fear, out of patriotism, nationalism. At a certain point, racial superiority and nationalism trumps their supposed belief in the Christian gospel. It's just incredibly shameful what goes on there. And of course, there were a few Christians, some Christians, who did offer some resistance, but oftentimes they broke under pressure. But a few remained loyal, you know, even in the midst of persecution. Hence, the folk concept of the world is in profound accord with nature's will because it restores the free play of the forces which will lead the race through stages of sustained reciprocal education toward a higher type until, finally, the best portion of mankind will possess the earth and will be free to work in every domain all over the world and even reach spheres that lie outside the earth, whatever that means. So, ironically, or rather predictably, it's Hitler himself, see, who ushers in the dark shroud of a new barbarian era that engulfs the earth. But he does it, again, based on this principle of racial superiority, which necessitates a strong totalitarian state to carry out the agenda. Any comments before we gonna wrap things up here? I don't want to go much beyond 8:30 because I understand the weather is going to get kind of unsettled, and I'm sure the temperature is dropping out there. So let me see here. And we can come back and touch on any points that you'd like to talk about next week related to Hitler, because I know we're not doing him justice in the time we have here. And if anybody deserves justice, it would be Adolf Hitler. But let me just close with a few comments here on Hitler and Christianity. He understands that he needs to cast a new vision for the German people if his Nazification program is going to succeed. And so he appeals, as we said, to national pride and racial pride, and oftentimes declares that it's Germany's providential destiny to be a great and a powerful nation. Hitler occasionally dredges up Christian rhetoric, especially early on in his regime, not so much later. And this vision alone, see, would inspire the kind of fanatical zeal and devotion and sacrifice that was necessary for the German people to go out and dominate Europe. Now, like Machiavelli, Hitler uses the Christian religion very cynically in order to further his social and political agenda. Hitler puts it this way, quote, "This human world of ours would be inconceivable without the practical existence of a religious belief." Now, he's not saying he believes in God. He's saying that people need religion, see. "The great masses of a nation are not composed of philosophers." Thank God, you know. "For the masses of people, especially, faith is absolutely the only basis of a moral outlook on life." Now, again, he's using the word moral in the sense that it promotes his agenda. "The various substitutes that have been offered have not shown any results that might warrant us in thinking that they might usefully replace the existing denominations of Christianity in Germany." So in other words, he's saying that Christianity serves a very useful purpose in our society. There's no other kind of religious systems that would be as effective as German so-called Christianity in terms of, you know, rallying the people. Until such a substitute for religion is available, only fools and criminals would think of abolishing the existing religion. So again, it's a very pragmatic approach. And when you have Catholic priests and when you have Protestant ministers that are dutifully following the Nazi agenda, constantly preaching to their people that we need to obey our governing authorities, then tyrants and dictators can use this, you know, very, very effectively in keeping control over the people. So, in the case of Hitler, he's alternately friendly and hostile toward the Lutheran churches, the Reformed churches, and the Roman Catholic state churches. He tolerates these churches, provided the clergy cooperates with his program. But anybody who opposes him, obviously, on moral grounds, is severely persecuted. And this starts early on in his regime. You know, he took over in Germany in 1933, and by at least 1935, already the Nazis were pressuring the churches to conform and get with the Nazi agenda or else, you know, suffer severe consequences. So, unsurprisingly, now keep in mind, see, most of your Catholics, most of your Lutherans, most of your Reformed Christians in Germany have for generations absorbed and adopted liberal theology, which is heresy. It's apostate Christianity. And so that's the state of German so-called Christianity at this time, see. And so it shouldn't be surprising to us that liberal Christians and secular Jews who already had compromised so much, they have these very flexible doctrines and very flexible morality like liberal Christians do today. So it shouldn't come as a surprise that they were generally quite compliant when it came to acceding to the Nazi agenda. Certainly more than those who had conservative Orthodox Christian beliefs. And so a good example, and we'll talk about this person in a few weeks, Rudolf Bultmann, one of the most prominent liberal Lutheran pastors and theologians at Germany at the time. Although Bultmann never publicly joined the Nazi party or supported the Nazis, he also never publicly ever criticized the Nazis. Bultmann played it very safe, and he was sufficiently ambiguous to the point that he was never prosecuted or persecuted. And he did at one time join the Confessing Church movement, which was this minority group among Lutheran and Reformed Christians that were trying to uphold the integrity of the Christian faith. For a time, he associated with the Confessing Church, but he never publicly challenged the Nazi movement. And in fact, he oftentimes would criticize the leaders in the Confessing Church for holding to what he called was an outdated view of Christian orthodoxy, a traditional Christian orthodoxy that, as he put it, was not suitable for the 20th century. So here we have in Rudolf Bultmann sort of the premier example of the Christian hypocrite, or at least the, you know, so-called Christian hypocrite. Here's somebody that is a pastor and a theologian. Every Sunday, he goes into his Lutheran church, and they go through the traditional Lutheran liturgy, which is very orthodox, very biblically oriented. And then he spends the whole rest of his week as a seminary professor deconstructing and undermining all those basic core principles that are put forth in the liturgy and the creeds of the Lutheran Church. But it served his purpose. He was never persecuted during World War II. So Hitler's intention, as far as we know it, was eventually, of course, to replace traditional Christianity with a state religion that was basically an expression of traditional German paganism and occultism. In fact, many of the early leaders in the Nazi party were very actively involved in the occult. Some historians believe that that's actually what started this whole National Socialist movement, was a bunch of people that were very much involved in demonic activity and the occult and so on, and they were sort of the pioneers of what became eventually the Nazi party. So Hitler will cynically use so-called Christianity for his own ends, but eventually, if he had had his way, he would have abolished it, and they would have returned to his idea of a more noble religion, which was ancient German paganism. Again, my apologies. That leaves an awful lot to be said about Hitler. So again, if If you have any particular thoughts, comments, questions about Hitler in particular, please, you know, feel free to raise those issues next week. And we'll try to set aside a few minutes to do that. Before we move on with the next books in our series, which is Sigmund Freud, who, along with Darwin and Marx and, you know, Nietzsche, is one of the titanic figures in the development of modern Western history. And then we'll also look at Margaret Sanger and Margaret Mead, and I think you'll find them to be very, very interesting characters, okay? Both very much in the forefront of the sexual revolution of the 20th century. So, well, that was a lot of words. Thank you for your attention, and I hope that was insightful. And again, just the depths of human degradation. And yet, there's far more to come. Primarily, by the way, once we get into the 20th century, it's primarily sexual stuff. That's kind of the cutting edge of decadence. It was always there in the past, but it becomes so pronounced and such a prominent theme in the 20th century. So, anything before we go? Oh no, you're so depressed. Thank God that we have the light and truth of Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm.